Welcome to Calibrate Conversations, a podcast about embracing God's standard for sexuality. I'm your host, Brady Cohn. I'm really excited about today's episode. Make sure you like it, leave a nice comment if you feel so kind. But today we have some special guests, Matt and Andrea Crum from Texas. They have a ministry, Genuine Family Ministries, and I really appreciate getting to know them the last few weeks, hearing their heart for people. They minister to parents with whose kids have transgender issues. They have a book called Christ Over Culture. And today I want to give them the opportunity to tell you all about it and share some of their teaching on gender roles, feminism, all kinds of cultural issues that we need to be equipped to really navigate and understand how culture has maybe affected our families, our lives, and even maybe crept into our form of Christianity that we need some correction on. So welcome, Matt and Andrea. Good morning, and tell us about you. What's going on?
Good morning. Well, we're Matt and Andrea Crum with Genuine Family Ministries. We are, as you said, in Texas, and we, you know, our ministry is all about equipping parents to stand firm on their faith. And so they take that learning and teaching and to teach their kids to stand firm on their faith in this culture because of all the stuff that's coming at them these days with transgenderism, LGBTQ, you know, just the stuff that's going on in, you know, politics or whatever. But it's all about the foundation of the Word of God, the Bible, what that says, and how to notice those things when it comes in the worldview compared to the Christian worldview. And so, yeah, that's pretty much it in a nutshell. So,
awesome. Awesome. Yeah, obviously, like, tell us a little bit about your past. You guys are believers. You've raised, you still have a couple kids at home. You're raising your kids. What issues or what happened in your own lives like that made you decide, gosh, we have got to start investing in some people and equipping the church? Was there any particular things that you saw, or was it just over time that you saw that the body of Christ really needs to be equipped in the area of a biblical family?
Yeah, I would say, you know, probably a lot of it started with our own just realization of where we had prioritized wrong in our own family and where we had made work and career and all these other things more important, and started to really focus on our faith, focused on just following what God had been calling us to. And in that process, I know for me, I had got let go for my job, and I was just really trying to figure out, Lord, what do you have for us next? And really asking him for the first time, what do you have for us next? And we had already started the process of really making sure we were being intentional in our family. And through that process, though, the Lord really started opening my eyes, just as I was talking to other women and I was having coffees and I was figuring out, like, realizing that Lord was calling me to minister to these women, that there's a lot of people out there, a lot of, you know, quote unquote Christians who seem to have some progressive beliefs, specifically around the topics of LGBTQ, maybe unity conversations related to racial conversations. And just really started to try to think through, is this because people are compromising their beliefs? Like, they're just not really firm in what they're believing, or they're willing to just not stay firm because for the sake of relationship? Or is it because that people don't really know what they believe? And I think there's a combination of the both, but what we really want to focus on with our ministry is just helping people know what they believe and why they believe it. Because when you're talking about the gospel, you're talking about sin and salvation. And these are really the cornerstone of the conversations we need to be having, and not ever, of course, approve anything that supports sin, but also be compassionate with people who are in it. You know, and I think that's been one of the most exciting things that God has done in our lives through it, is really making sure that we can minister to people who are actually in some of these ideologies or fallen victim. I call them victims because I think the world tells them it's okay. And yes. That sort of thing. So I think that's, but that's kind of what brought us to it, was really just an own examination in our own life. And then things that God continued to kind of reveal as we were trying to figure out, okay, God, what would you have next for us?
Awesome. You know, I think that you make a great point that a lot of people are ignorant, and then there's a lot of people who are victims. And I always try to point out that there's a difference between the sheep who are hurting and wounded, who have been led astray, versus the wolves who are the ones deceiving them and are have an agenda and are intentionally leading people astray. And so sometimes I think that you know, and fighting off the wolves, we kind of accidentally shoot the sheep too with our attitudes and behavior towards them. And that's why, you know, we want to come alongside people. We want to love them with grace. We want to understand what is the foundation of their worldview. Where have they been led astray? And maybe sometimes it turns out that they are wolves, but most the time I find that they're sheep who just don't know any different, and they've been led astray. And so we want to have grace and compassion for that and come alongside them and disciple them into the truth. You guys minister to parents and individuals with transgenderism, specifically within the LGBTQ spectrum. You've really focused on transgenderism. So let's talk about just how did God give you a heart for those individuals and those parents whose kids are struggling? And then just what patterns do you see in their lives? How do you see God working to bring people out of it? And what lies do you see that they have believed? I think that we're all kind of desperate to understand that issue and what to do with it. And so, you know, I share my thoughts all the time on that issue, but I'd love to hear your guys' experiences, because you are in the thick of it. And I think a lot of Christians who maybe talk about these things will spout off talking points, but they're not actually ministering to people who are struggling. And you guys are actually ministering to people who are struggling and their parents. And so I want to hear about what you're experiencing and seeing there.
You know, it's interesting how when we started the ministry, Andrea started it with Genuine Women, and people were coming up to her after she would speak, and we were starting to see fathers along in those talks and stuff. And they were come to us and they're like, hey, you know, my daughter's dressing this way, or she's going down this path. And, you know, with that, it was kind of a direction that we didn't know our ministry was going to take or branch off of our ministry. But so we had enough people come to us after and just to talk about that. And we're like, okay, well, maybe we just need to get a group and just kind of talk and get these people together and not only, you know, guide them in biblical truth, but also where they can also talk with each other, they're going through certain circumstances together. And so, and I think, personally, that's one of my favorite things about the group is that they, you know, people were telling them to go to biblical or to Christian counseling, and well, the counselors are affirming their kids, and so they were able to share those experiences with each other and learn from each other. You know, so, you know, one group of parents could be just starting out, where another group of parents are have been in it a couple of years and can say, hey, this is what you need to do. We know where you're at, and to give them encouragement that things are going to get better. Things do get better. And I think one of the biggest things I think that we've given advice with the parents is about the pronouns, you know, because a lot of those kids want their first thing they want is to be, you know, called their preferred name or their pronoun or whatever. And I think once you open that door, it's hard to shut it. And so,
absolutely.
So I think that's the biggest thing we've kind of encouraged them to start off with is just call them by their name, because that's what God has given them. And I think my wife has said,
that's the name that the parent has given them.
Yes.
And it's like, you know, the parents gave birth to them and named them, and the parent knows who they are. And so I agree with that. I feel like I take a stronger stance on that than I used to, that parents need to hold the line there. Mm-hmm. And because once you open that door, like you said, it is really hard to go back, and we don't want to make it easier for our kids to continue down to go down the road of transitioning further, and we don't want to affirm their delusions and the lies that they are telling and being told about themselves.
Yeah, and I would add too, because as our friend Linda Hunsberger says, you know, when you do, if you do use those pronouns and that new name, you become part of their transition story. Like, you are now part yes. of it with them. And they don't stop Absolutely. There. That's a very common theme you hear, is they don't stop there. Once you give into one ask, then there's another ask, then there's another ask, and then mm-hmm. it's medicalization and surgeries and all the things.
It's always a moving goalpost. And so, you know, parents sometimes think, well, if I meet them in this place, then I can still keep relationship with them and it'll be fine and it'll help me have an influence. But then the goalpost is always moving, and then they demand something else.
Exactly. And that is, you know, you mentioned that you started to take a harder line on this topic. The place I've started to take a harder line too is even the dress and the attire, because that's also part of the social no. transition, the hair, the binding, the, you know, whatever it is. Because I think as, you know, we can look at culture and we can say, okay, the fact that women wear dresses or that we shave our legs or whatever it is, you know, maybe these are social constructs. Maybe these are things that we've just decided as a culture, and, you know, who really cares? But they do signify something in culture. They do signify, they have a symbol, you know, they mean something to people. And I've also found that yes. A lot of parents, because, you know, they're trying to figure out how much leeway can I give my kid without alienating them? How do I hold this line? It's very tricky. I mean, they're dealing with a lot of tension, right? Of trying to keep this relationship and trying to minister to their child and also not alienate them and ostracize them to the point that there's not a relationship anymore. It's very challenging. But I do think, so I've seen a lot of parents say, okay, fine, you can wear those clothes, right? Or you can do that to your hair. But that is part of the transition. And when they're doing that, they are putting on a mask. They are starting to assume the identity. And that's really, I think, the slippery slope and where all of this really begins, is once they start assuming the persona, whether the name is used or not, I think that's when it gets really difficult to start pulling them back.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that it can be hard for parents to discern, because, you know, when it comes to like the gender norms, like every culture is different. And I think it's important that it's like, okay, this does mean something. Wearing a dress does mean something in our culture. And sometimes I hear people making excuses of like, well, in other cultures, that's not how men dress, or that's not how women dress. Like, well, but we aren't living in other cultures. We're living in this culture. And certainly I think that there's leeway of, you know, like some girls are maybe naturally more what we call a tomboy, right? Mm-hmm. They're like less into the girly things. And mm-hmm. now our culture would label them as transgender and try to transition them, which is horrible. And we need to protect against that. And so, you know, I don't want to take those girls and try to put them in a box of making them super, super feminine. At the same time, where the difference is, if a child is trying to change how they're dressing out of an act of rebellion, like that is absolutely alarming. You know, maybe you have the girl who is just always been a little more of a tomboy, and that's fine. But a girl who's always been into really girly things, who now wants to wear boy clothes out of a rebellion against being a girl, like that is a heart level issue that needs to be addressed and dealt with. And it's so hard to discern, because, you know, we don't want to put our kids into just this very, very narrow box. And yet we need to deal with the heart of rebellion that is causing them to want to not conform to our kind of gender norms. And so that's kind of cloudy and confusing, and on what is an act of rebellion versus what is acceptable. And that takes a lot of wisdom for a parent to navigate through that. And that's where having other parents who have been through that and have had to navigate that is so extremely helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what really helps, is just to be able to see what's happening with other parents. And that's what's helped us, because we can see these trends and we can see what similarities have existed between families too. That helps us to be able to say, hey, I think that this is a common thread that maybe we want to try this differently. You know, we talk about, because there just wasn't really a playbook, right? I mean, this is difficult stuff. And a lot of this, a lot of it accelerated, obviously, in the last 10 years, more like the last 5 years. And so parents are just caught off guard, and they're doing the best that they can with what they're trying to do. And they don't know what are the right steps and what's not. And so that's why we are trying to say, okay, these are the things we've seen. How can we do this differently? Not because we just think this is the right thing, but we can see that this is what's actually been happening, you know?
Yeah. And I would also add that, like, we are talking about, like, just complete rebellion, or just someone who, a girl that's maybe a tomboy, you know, a lot of those tomboyish girls are targeted by their peers that are in that lifestyle. And so knowing what is truth and what isn't is, like Andrea was saying, this is what our ministry is all about. We were wanting the parents and us to come alongside and teach the difference between the lies and the truth of this world and the views that they have. And so if one of those tomboy girls knows the truth, they can brush it off, you know, and know where they stand with Christ. But a lot of those people get targeted by their peers that are in that lifestyle. And that's something that they, you know, obviously need to be aware of. So.
Absolutely. Yes. There's a lot of wolves that are targeting vulnerable sheep, and they see kids that are more susceptible. Are there any other, traits amongst kids, or any other segments of kids that you're seeing to be more susceptible to be targeted or lured into transgender ideology? What are you seeing there?
Yeah, I would say that I always call it the four A's, I think, and that you could, there's more. This isn't necessarily all in, you know, everything. But I definitely think that the kids who are susceptible, you will see typically, and it can be one or more of these things, but one, there could be, you know, some kind of anxiety or depression that they're experiencing for whatever, a number of reasons. And then, of course, they're doing social media, they're scrolling, they're looking at all these different stories that tell them if they just did this and just did this, and they would be happy and their life would be better and they wouldn't be in the distress that they're in. Also, autism seems to be very linked to this particular, especially transgenderism. There seems, you know, if I was a parent of somebody with autism, I would definitely be very vigilant about what they're exposed to and the access they have, especially on social media, especially in schools, universities, even in public schools, because they're going to be more susceptible. People who are artistic, people who are creative, you find a lot of times that is going to be a group of people typically more sensitive, typically more justice oriented, more merciful and compassionate. So you definitely find, I feel like, a lot more of this ideology targets people who see the world a little bit different, you know, and they've also sometimes been maybe been bullied or not accepted or not let in. And so they feel a little bit other, you know, in that way. And then the other category I'd say that's common, and often you don't really necessarily know that this is there, but abuse, you know, abuse is going to be a very common, Absolutely. Either whether it's sexual abuse, or mental and emotional abuse, growing up in harsh homes, I think plays a role. But also, of course, being sexually abused is going to play a big role as well.
Absolutely. And that should give us a lot of compassion. And, you know, when I talked about the abuse aspect. It's like, gosh, I never wanted to put someone in a box and assume that they were abused. But there's such a extremely high prevalence of LGBTQ people who were abused. Now, all of a sudden, it's so much of a social contagion that there's a lot of them, you know, identifying as all those identities, where it's not very deep. It's just more of a social thing. But there are so many who have been abused, and that should give us some pause and some compassion. And when I'm talking to someone who's LGBTQ, I have that in the back of my mind, is that there could be some deep, deep trauma and pain that has helped harden their heart and helped lead them to this place and made them more susceptible.
I would also add too, I think that a lot of times when we think about abuse, we think about it physically, like in person, but there's a lot of abuse going on online. And yes. Even through the porn industry and some of these things, it is abuse. And so they may never have been physically abused in the way that we typically think about, but absolutely through their experience, they have still been the same level of abuse that we would think of somebody who's been physically abused.
Yes, absolutely. And that should cause parents to take so much caution when it comes to social media and access the internet. And I think so many parents are just naive. And I hear a lot of parents say, oh, I'd rather have my kids have it now while they're in my home and I can shepherd them, but they don't even realize what their kids are currently doing on social media and pornography. And so the shepherding isn't happening because they've already been kind of taken by the wolves and are addicted and are being influenced in ways that the parents have no idea.
Yeah, I agree. The social media and other avenues are a big problem in that area. And it's something that even if you put restrictions, it still needs to be monitored. And I think our son, he doesn't have social media. Our oldest, none of them do. Both boys don't. And they won't until I think they're out of the house and graduated. But
they're 32.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't give a phone to our oldest until he was a freshman. And that was just mainly necessary because he's playing sports and needed to be picked up and stuff like that. So, but yeah, I think you were right on the nose with the shepherding. I mean, yeah, they want to give him a phone, but they're not, you know, even monitoring or anything like that. And that's where the big dangers come in.
Yes, absolutely. I want to take some time and talk about feminism. And so this is something I've been wanting to talk about more on the podcast. I'm going to be doing a series on gender roles. I kind of stepped in a big one a while back with a post I made about gender roles and realized, okay, I need to talk about this more because I think that feminism has had such a bigger and profound influence on us than most of us would realize, and crept into the church and influenced how we view family, and it's disrupting our families. And so I would love for you to talk about a little bit of the history of feminism throughout the decades and the different impact and lies it's led us to believe, and how then it's affected our families and our view of the world and our view of women, so forth.
Yeah, this is personal, I think, to me and I think our family, because I definitely bought into so many lies of feminism and I didn't even realize it. Like, I totally would have told you I was anti-feminist. like, I didn't believe in a lot of the ideas like abortion and, you know, all these kind of things, bodily autonomy, like all the things that are part of the cultural vernacular today in terms of sex positivity and so many things. So I didn't believe in any of those things, but I think I definitely bought into a lot of the lies in terms of women empowerment and what I can do anything you can do. And I can have, you know, both the family and the career and juggle it all. And, you know, so I definitely believe I really, fell into that lie. And so it's personal to me. And I think it, you know, we're really seeing how God has really showed us what it needs to look like in the home. So I'm very thankful to the Lord for his grace and for showing us a different way, because I definitely was all about my career for a long time. I would say, so feminism, just the phases of feminism, the first wave, they call it the wave, was really over 100 years ago. And it was, around the 1850s, 1860s. And it was really about women's rights to vote. I mean, that was a lot of it. There were other issues in there as well, property rights and things like that, but it was really a lot around the right to vote. I think if you talk to most women that they would say, hey, that seemed like a really good, you know, part of feminism. We like that part of feminism. I think it had its trouble even then, but for the most part, people were pretty much think, okay, you know, we understand where they were coming from. I think it was definitely, you know, a rejection of maybe feeling oppressed in the home, maybe men maybe taking more liberties sometimes, and being, you know, not taking care of the home like they needed to in terms of protecting and loving and serving their families, you know. So I think there was some of that going on in the culture. Of course, can't speak to it, wasn't there, but that's my impression based on what I've read. But then you get to second wave feminism, and that's really when you get, I think, to what we're really seeing the explosion of today, which of course was the sexual revolution. This is when 1960s, 1970s, this is when women wanted to have everything. They wanted to have everything men had, and they wanted to have sex without consequences. They wanted to have the job. They wanted to go out. And several things were happening in culture in that time. You had no-fault divorce, which was brought into law. You have the abortion legalized, and you have the pill. And so you had a lot of things happening on a government level that were actually allowing this kind of progressive stance for women to continue on. And what we saw really, and what we see as a result, I mean, Matt and I are both, you know, we come from broken homes, you know, and so, and you saw that, that's what you started to see: broken homes, broken families, parents, more divorce. You saw the woman leaving the home, the husband working two income families. And so now you've got a whole bunch of kids who are growing up without that guidance from their parents in the home. And then as you get into third wave feminism, which is really like 1980s, 1990s, this is when intersectionality. So this is a term that basically means looking at the oppressed categories, the marginalized categories. Mm-hmm. And basically, if somebody has more than one category that they're part of, if they're gay and woman, then they have, you know, multiple intersections. And so their plight is maybe more important, or they have more injustice that they've experienced in life. And so their lived experience is more important than others. But that's when you start to see this whole conversation around not just what has traditionally been called the white woman's second wave is really kind of the white women feminist movement. And then as you get into third wave, it's really considered more of the more inclusive wave of feminism that was talking to issues that Black women were experiencing, issues that LGBTQ women were experiencing. And so they look at it more as something that was, you know, you start to see more conversation around those things. And then fourth wave feminism is what we're in today. And it's really just a conglomeration of so many things. You definitely see more trans rights in fourth wave feminism. You saw fourth wave feminism was kind of kicked off by the Me Too movement, which was a social media really movement platform after a lot of things that they were talking about with Harvey Weinstein and some of these people, Jeffrey Epstein, you know, all these kind of things were going on in culture. And so there was started this conversation about sexual abuse that women had experienced. But then you also see more of a sex positivity conversation coming out. So it's kind of a conglomeration of a lot of things. It doesn't have any one, I would say, guiding post, which is why it feels a little more chaotic, I think, than the rest of the movements that seemed a little bit more cohesive, or at least they had a primary goal that they were trying to reach for. So all of these things, these are the waves that just continue to progress. And it's really had a huge impact on the home. It's had a huge impact on women. It's had a huge impact on the way that we view ourselves. Like, I definitely didn't see myself as the nurturing mom type. I just believed I was this, you know, assertive boss woman, you know, and I think a lot of women find themselves in that kind of position, especially if they didn't grow up in a family where there was that you know, two parents, you know, two biological parents raising you, that sort of thing. There's a lot of misconception about marriage, what it's supposed to look like. And then we're out here trying to do better for our kids sometimes. And, but we don't necessarily have, the structure to look back on and to see what it was supposed to look like in the first place. So we're kind of making our way, you know? So yeah, there's been a lot of destruction. And one of the things I find interesting is that in research, you know, the male, we know from God's design that the male is more of the protector, right? He's the one who's to protect. And they find that in research that kids who don't have the father in the home, they feel less secure. They feel less worthy. They feel the absence of the protector in their home. And then we also know through scripture and God's design that women are more of the nurturers. And they find that kids who don't have the mom in the home have more anxiety. They have more attachment disorders. They lack empathy. There's things that mom gives the kids that only mom can give the kids. There's things that dad gives the kids that only dad can give the kids. And that goes straight back to scripture and it goes straight back to biology.
Absolutely. You know, throughout all those waves of feminism, there's usually a very hint of truth, or sometimes the problem they're responding to can be a real problem, right? And so we don't want to ignore that. It's just that when the answer is not biblical, then it's not dealing with the real issue. And so, you know, and then you get all these modern theories of critical theory and oppression, and it's oppressive. I think we live in a culture where any type of submission is oppressive. Submission to your elders is oppressive, you know, within the home. And so we're trying to, you know, destroy all these power structures that are oppressing us. And we should take, like, real abuse happens and we should take that seriously. And sometimes that's been overlooked. It's been covered up by church elders and pastors, and we that should be taken extremely, extremely seriously. But the problem, again, I think I said this earlier, the problem isn't God's design for gender, sexuality, family. The problem is sin. And so we should take sin issues seriously. And we should spur on men to love their wives like Christ loved the church. And if we spurred men on to do that, if they lived that out, there would be no abuse in the home, right? And so the answer is more biblical teaching on gender and sexuality and manhood and womanhood, not a rebellion from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's something that, like, when we started the ministry together, and but I was doing a lot of behind the scenes stuff, where she was kind of leading the way in the direction of the ministry. And the Lord really kind of got a hold of my heart, and I think it was on her heart too, that I needed to come along and be in this 100% and lead this ministry like I lead my home. The way God intended it to be. It's always struck me when she was talking about how, you know, the difference is if one of the parents is out of the house, the effects it has on the kids, and the different paths that they could actually go down with that, with the absence of a father or a mother. And, you know, a lot of that is due to, it's just they need to have both parents in the home and the father leading the way, and the way the Bible has said for it to happen. And unfortunately, we're not seeing that a lot these days. And even if they have both parents in the home, how many of those parents are actually following what the Word says and leading their family, you know? And so I think that's something that obviously needs to be addressed, and that, and hopefully what our ministry is helping that do.
Yeah. And I think to your point, I just am a firm believer that the Bible, scripture, God's word, God's way, God's design works for every single person, every single time, regardless of your gender, your socioeconomic status, your ethnicity, where you were born. If we apply what God has taught us, like, it works for absolutely everybody. Everybody everybody would flourish because God is for everybody. He created all of us in his image. There is none that he favors more than the other, right? And so his word is good and it's faithful. And if, like you said, yes, there has been abuse, there has been problems. A lot of the things we see today are reactions to ways the church got it wrong, ways Christians got it wrong because of sin or because of self-righteousness or, you know, all the things that get involved. But, you know, if we did just follow what God called us to, we wouldn't see the number of people, I think, decrying church hurt and some of the things that we see today. And one of the reasons it makes it easy for me to submit to Matt is because he's a honorable, wonderful, loving husband. He is so supportive of me. There is no oppressive feeling ever, you know? And so, and he loves me the way that Christ has called him to love me. And because of that, this isn't a difficult task. But I think that that's, you know, what, you know, we need to be seeing in the church. We need to be seeing that. And the people I know, a lot of men are, you know, treat their women, their wives, their women, treat their wives the way that, that Matt treats me. And so I see a lot of goodness, you know, I see a lot of goodness in these men. And I think it makes it easier, to fall in line with, you know, that kind of what God has called in terms of order. But yeah, if that's not what's happening in the family, then there has to be self-examination and repentance and asking God for forgiveness and asking God to show another way so that the husband and the wife can live in the way that he's called us to.
Absolutely. And I think that we've just had such a lack of discipleship in that area and vision for that within the church. And, you know, and so then our families within the church don't look that much different than culture. And certainly, you know, we want to show massive amounts of grace to people who have already, you know, made choices and messed this up. We're not here to condemn them. We want to see them to see God's goodness and grace and come alongside them. And there's now families where it's never going to be the ideal because choices have already been made, but they can make new choices now. And they can go into God's word, and they can be supported by those around them. And where the ideal is lacking, God's grace is sufficient. And just taking responsibility over that and surrendering that to the Lord is a huge step in growing in godliness to then be able to lead our families well, even if we have made some poor decisions in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's very key what you said is like, yeah, you have all the families in the church and you could see families that might have it all together, but they really don't. But or you have examples, great examples of how a husband and a father should lead the home. But there's no discipleship or training in that. And I think that's very vital because a lot of people, yeah, they know they might read the Bible and see what it says, but how is that? What are the practical steps in leading your family and leading, being the spiritual leader of your home? And I think we need more than that. That's really all I can say to that. So,
and I think sometimes, absolutely, you know, I really look at when we were growing up, I think in the church, you know, there just was a really, especially the churches, evangelical churches we grew up in, there was really a seeker friendly element to it. And there wasn't a lot of depth. I think that's actually why we have a lot of biblical illiteracy today. We'd have a lot of people that came out of the church that just said a quick prayer and never really understood what it meant to follow Christ or what they were even agreeing to when they said that prayer. And so I even understood what they believed in that moment. And so I think you have a lot of people who think, oh yeah, I'm a Christian, or I knew these, you know, or whatnot. And there's no foundation. And now we're the ones raising these kids. Yeah. Like this is really the problem. Yeah. It's like we had these like deficiencies, you know, lack of discipleship. We were not discipled, right? And then therefore now we're supposed to be discipling our kids, and we don't even know what that looks like. And really, what it looks like, you know, what I've come to from all you know, in the last 10 years is what it looks like is you following Christ, right? As an individual, as a parent. and then you pass down and you pour out whatever it is you're learning, what you're growing, yes, and what you're developing. It doesn't have to be a book. It doesn't have to be a podcast. It doesn't have to be, you know, a workbook and curriculum. All it really is just you getting poured into from the Lord and you're learning, and then you pouring out to somebody else with what
absolutely
you've, you know, and it really can look like that, but it has to start with us doing the work and leaning into the work.
Yes. You know, as I reflect on kind of the era I grew up in the 90s, I was kind of in and out of church as, you know, our family was in kind of a messy spot and we weren't always involved with church. Sometimes we were. But I think that one of the misconceptions was that a dad's only job is to provide. And they might say that they'd be like a fiscal protector, like, you know, if someone tries to break in my house, I'll get them, right? And so I saw a lot, at least this was just the Christianity I grew up with, a lot of the acceptance of a dad should be providing for his family. And I don't think that that means that a woman can never have any job of any kind, right? But priority should be on her family. But what was missed was that, or I think that the provision part of fatherhood was used as an excuse to not shepherd the kids or not lead within the home. It's like, well, I'm doing my job. I'm spending 12 hours a day at work to bring home a paycheck. And so my work is done, is kind of the culture amongst families that it seemed like I grew up with. And I know a lot in my generation who have experienced that. It's like, yeah, dad was gone all the time working, doing his Christian duty to provide, but there was no discipleship from him. There was no heart level shepherding from him. And he was emotionally detached. And that was considered to be okay because he was providing the paycheck and mom will do all the emotional things. And even though I think mom is more equipped and is usually doing more of the nurturing because, you know, she's in the home more, I've seen just that disconnect amongst godly fathers in my generation's parents, and every generation has their blind spots, but just a lack of discipleship, a lack of emotional connecting, a lack of shepherding, a lack of leadership in the home. Just go to work every day, do your job, provide, and that's it. And fatherhood should be so much more than that. Leadership of your marriage and discipleship is so much more than that. And I think that then those of us now who are trying to raise kids, we're scrambling to figure it out because we didn't have an example of that.
Yeah, and I think there was a stat I'd read somewhere where the chances of, you know, the kid coming to salvation was greater, like by a large margin, when the father accompanied the family to church, as opposed to the mom just taking the kids to church. And that really, I can't remember what the stat was, but that really stood out to me. Just the act of going to church with your kids speaks volumes to them. And they see that as a leadership, a spiritual leadership thing, even if it's subconscious, but it's there. He is going, he's taking the family to church. And that always just stood out to me as just a powerful, powerful thing, just what the father has on the family.
And we have to rethink the way that we're looking at work, you know, in our culture. You know, it's interesting. I think people would be surprised because if they asked me what is the greatest threat to the family or what's the greatest threat to Christians, I actually wouldn't say the culture. I would say it's our busyness. It's our lack of priorities. It's the focus on work and career and big houses that have taken a lot of times the husband and sometimes the mom out of the home. Dads who travel all the time, you know, working a lot of hours or whatever it is. For me, it was me doing a lot of those things. So whatever that looks like, we have to reprioritize and we have to stop trying to live a life the materialistic life, you know, the caring about things that just ultimately don't matter. I think a lot of kids, I know Matt and knowing his story and mine, it's like, you know, would have forgone big houses and big cars for time with our family, right? And time with our dad, time with our parents. And, yes, and I think that that is what is missing in a lot of times. So there's just this lack of realization and intentionality of saying, we're going to sacrifice some of these material things so that we can be together more as a family. And so even with our kids, I'm really trying to encourage them, start your own thing. Ask God what he has for you. Don't go into this corporate, you know, world. Don't think you have to go to college. Don't think you have to do these things that the world says you have to do. Build something on your own so you have flexibility with your family, so you can be there. Matt and I are both home. We both get to work from home and be there with our kids. He does 50% of the homeschooling and I do 50% of the homeschooling. We are here, you know, and that's a big deal, but that's because that's what we've cultivated over the last 5 years. That wasn't easy. There was a lot of sacrifice. It's been very painful. That's a whole other conversation, but you know, but it's been worth it. And, you know, even recently I was reading something about how, I think there's just stats that talk about, especially young boys, right? There's a time when they start developing and growing and they stop needing their mom as much and they start needing their father more. It's around the time of 11, 12 puberty type age. And so it's essential for the husbands and the fathers to have cultivated the relationship up to that point, and then to even be there even more, I think, as they're growing into adulthood.
Absolutely. You know, and this modern concept of the father working outside the home is a relatively new thing in history. It wasn't since, you know, it's only been since the Industrial Revolution that most fathers work outside the home. Before, it was like everyone, it was an entrepreneur providing a good or service. And it was like the family business usually run from home and kids worked with their parents. And if you had a, you know, a blacksmith shop or whatever it was, you know, you worked together with it as a family. And, so kids spend their entire childhood with their parents. Yeah. And I think that we've just become so hardened to that, and it seems so impossible. And certainly I honor, you know, parents who do what they have to provide for their kids, but we should have a better long-term vision, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and we should make career choices accordingly that allow us to spend as much time as possible with our kids and be intentional with them, and not career choices that are going to take dad out of the house for 12 hours a day or whatever it is, and be completely disconnected from their kids. It's like, I know a lot of families where it's like the kids don't even know what dad does for a living. He just leaves for 12 hours a day and then comes home and says goodnight. And I think that it's tragic. And again, it's like, I understand parents have to provide for their kids, but then let's figure out a long-term plan for how this can change in the future, whether it's a smaller house, a different career path, and let's disciple our kids to make that priority. But there's so many Christian households where the priority is like, go off to college and get the best job to have the best retirement someday. And, we've got to disciple our kids with different priorities in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think we also have to be real. I mean, I know this was true for me, and I know this is true, I'm sure, for a lot of men too. I got a lot of accolades at work. I like productivity. I like getting things done. It felt great to be recognized. And I think a lot of us, you know, and then we come home and there's not that same level of appreciation, you know, because now it's hard work and the kids may be doing other things. They may not even want to spend time with us at that moment, you know, or there's more to do. And it just is taxing on a whole other level that it doesn't feel as rewarding at the time. But it is so rewarding, and it does develop fruit. And there is, like, we're just so thankful. We have such a sweet relationship with both of our boys and our family. We're very close, you know, and if we had been on the trajectory we were 10 years ago, it would not look like this, you know, it wouldn't look like this at all. And so we're very thankful to have made those shifts. But I think we also have to be real with ourselves, like, what's driving me to always want that job or that work or whatever it is, because there are internal motivators that a lot of times are driving us that we have to admit to, you know.
Yes. And that's where we all just need some discipleship to examine our hearts. You know, what am I getting out of my job that I need actually some security in Christ instead? You know, and like you said, is my job a place where I'm seeking too much affirmation? Am I seeking escape? Am I you know, is mom working outside the home so she can escape the chaos of the kids? And like, we can admit those things. We're all sinners. We're all broken. We're all fallen. And we need some discipleship to discern what is going on in our heart and what is driving the decisions that we are making that then is affecting our kids. And I think, and that's where feminism doesn't allow us to ask those questions. And we need to be asking those questions of ourselves and others around us, and us, you know, submitting them to the Lord and finding our value, our identity, our hope from the Lord. And that means that we can spend more time at home in the midst of the chaos in a what feels like very thankless role at times, because our security and our value comes from the Lord. And we see the bigger picture, and we have people spurring us on and encouraging us and you know, showing that what we are doing does have value.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree with that. So
yeah.
Awesome. Well, I want to end by, you know, connecting people with your resources. You guys wrote a book called Christ Over Culture. Tell us about a little bit about the book.
Yeah. So the book is really, it was really built, with the framework of wanting to educate parents specifically on the biblical worldview versus the postmodern worldview of today, and really help people, parents, understand that the postmodern worldview is built on a framework of ideas of power structure and margin, like oppressed and oppressor as it relates to marginalized communities. Because the framework, whether you're talking about feminism or whether you're talking about gender and sexual identity or whether you're talking about critical race theory or whether you're talking about progressive Christianity or whether you're talking about, you know, Hamas and Israel, like whatever topic you're talking about, if you're looking at the biblical worldview or the postmodern worldview, you're really going to see this framework unfold with the postmodern worldview. And so the whole plan, the whole point of the book is to really start educating on how this framework exists so that we can teach our kids to discern the framework, so that when they're looking at social media or they're reading the news or they're talking to their neighbor or they're talking to the kids at church, whoever it is, they can see the ideas for what they are, because everything is being served up to them like truth. And every single person's perspective, you know, we, you know, if you have a platform on social media or any place, we're all sharing our perspectives and we share it as truth because it's what we know and what we understand and what we believe. And it all is coming to our kids that way. And so they don't know how to discern what is real and what is not, what is from God, what is not. And so really helping them understand worldview and understand specifically this postmodern worldview is what the book is all about.
Great. We will put a link to that in the show notes so people can find it and find that book on Amazon. That'll be awesome. What about your ministry, Genuine Family Ministries? You guys do webinars, you do conferences. How can people connect with you there? What do you have to offer to help people navigate this?
We really, if you go to our website, genuinefamilyministries.com, there's a lot of information on what we do, but also there's a link to our community, which is not associated with Facebook or anything like that. It's so we don't have the restrictions or filters or whatever. So it's, and we can, the link is on our website. We also offer a free Raising Christian Biblical Kids Toolkit. You can sign up for that. But yeah, a lot of the stuff's on our website, and especially our community, where we can share ideas, and a lot of the webinars are done through the community. So.
Awesome. Awesome. Yep. So connect there at genuinefamilyministries.com. Well, Matt and Andrea, thank you so much. I'm so glad that our friend Linda connected us a while back, and I'm encouraged by what you are doing, especially where I think I'm so encouraged that you're actually ministering to people and people with LGBTQ issues. I see so many people with a platform where it's like, you know, talking down at them, spouting off things. Some of those things are true and good, but you're actually doing the work of the ministry by ministering and discipling to people. And that's one thing that I really, really appreciate about you. You're not just talking about it. You're actually living it and applying biblical truth to people's lives.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're so glad to know you too, Brady. All right. And thank you for having us.
Yep. Thank you. All right. Well, thank you everyone for joining us on this episode of Calibrate Conversations. Check out calibrateministries.com for more podcast episodes, ministry resources. We really appreciate you tuning in. Have a great week. Thank you.